Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto talking to you from Dallas, Texas, where we're not quite as cold as they are in western Pennsylvania, but we're going to have probably a little bit of ice over the weekend. And, of course, when you think of ice in our part of the country, it means that people don't know how to drive, and it becomes a rather hilarious thing to watch on TV as you see people trying to drive through the ice. So it's probably good that it happens on a Saturday or a Sunday when there are less people driving around as they normally would be. On a weekday, it's always bad when it happens in the middle of rush hour in the morning, when it just the whole city goes through a rather hysterical experience. But today we're going to talk about Iraq. Our good friend Jonathan is back with us. Hi, Jonathan. How are you?
I'm doing good.
Jonathan Henry, of course. You're in Western Pennsylvania, aren't you? So
yeah.
What's your weather like?
We got lucky with this weather that came through the plains. We had this nice little bubble of like warm air. I think. Wednesday or Tuesday night, it was about 60 degrees outside. It was really unseasonably warm, and my wife and I went out for a walk, and I don't know, you know, a polar tech and a jacket and everything. And I came back and I was pretty much sweating. It was, but now it's, you know, that system's been pushed out of the way and it's getting colder.
It must have been like baseball weather, right? To go see the Pirates.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's always the fun part of the wheel that I always used to enjoy was whenever spring training would start. And it would be, you know, we'd have several inches of snow on the ground and be able to listen to how things are going on in Florida. And it kind of gives you a little taste of things, you know, yet to come. So
I recall living in Wisconsin and in Baltimore when the weather in March would be cold. At least, you know, it was kind of nice listening to the spring training baseball game on the radio, because at least you knew that the winter was going to end in a couple of weeks. So it was kind of a psychological lift, you know, to get over some of the winter. But just a quick reaction from you. Obviously, we're going to talk about Iraq, but this baseball story is all over the news. What's your reaction to it?
It's kind of really disappointing, because at first I was like, nah, it's not really. For me, my first reaction was, nah, I really don't care. But I thought about it more and, you know, thought back to what went on during the 80s and 90s. Really, for me, it was kind of like we all used to sit around and, you know, discuss baseball. And Jose Canseco, and that was one of the big names that stuck with me today. I was like, wow, I remember, you know, everyone was all on board for Jose Canseco. And then, you know, all these other names, Jose Guillen as well. And then to find out that, you know, they have been involved in this huge scandal, it's you know, more and more of a disappointment. So it's always kind of like, oh yeah, they were a great player, you know, put the asterisk after it. So
yeah, it is. You're right. You mentioned Canseco, of course. He was on top of his game when my sons were like 2 or 3 years old, and I can remember my kids had, you know, Canseco T-shirts, and I remember taking my kids to the ballpark here just to watch Canseco and Maguire. They were huge fans,
mm-hmm,
of those two guys. And it is for me too. It is really a disappointment. It really makes you wonder, though, you know, what are they going to do? And who knows? It's a tough call. I hate to be in the commissioner's shoes, because I don't know how much power he really has to fix the problem. And at the same time, it is a public relations nightmare, because people... I saw a poll today that came out, and I don't know how good a poll like this would be so quickly after, but I think the poll said something that many people would question the validity of the game when they watch a game because of all of this. So I don't know. I think it's a public relations disaster,
mm-hmm,
for Major League Baseball, and it's going to probably take a while for people to be able to get over it. But let's get into Iraq, which is your area of expertise. You know, it's funny, I laughed a great deal when I got your email today confirming that you were going to be on, because you said Iraq is getting boring.
Yeah.
And I had to laugh at that, because you're exactly right. Iraq is getting boring, which means that, you know, people are getting up in the morning, they're going to work, they're taking the kids to school, they're doing business, they're going to the stock market, they're doing the kinds of things, I guess, you know, the kinds of things that are boring.
Yeah.
And I had to laugh a great deal about that. But that's what's happening over there. Things are getting kind of boring, aren't they?
Yeah. For me, I like a really dynamic kind of month where a lot of things happen that really change a lot of the dynamics for the country. If Al-Qaeda or someone's losing leadership, or you have some type of a group appears, which throws a little something, and, you know, changes up everything, and that makes things exciting for me. I get to see, ooh, I wonder how, you know, what's going to come of this. For November, it was pretty much every day, you know, our guys, and of course, by saying our, that's the Iraqi troops plus Americans plus coalition going out and, you know, capturing some bad guys and providing some stability here and there, and throughout the country. And that was, you know, just pretty much the same. There wasn't anything really major you saw throughout the country. I mean, one of the biggest events you saw was Al-Qaeda move out of Baghdad. You know, they've been pushed out of Baghdad. They've been pushed, you know, there's little groups to the south, pretty much the south and southeast. Everyone else has been pushed to the north and northeast, and there was an operation that went on, Operation Iron Hammer, that went on in the northern part of the country within four provinces up there, and went to go and put pressure on Al-Qaeda there, and they've, you know, moved back into Diyala province, and of course the Iraqis have started operations there, and so now they're getting pushed back and forth between, you know, the Iraqis and Diyala and you know, the U.S. and the Iraqis in the northern part of the country.
Yeah, let me ask you kind of a military question, something that I have, that I've thought about before. If you move Iraq out of Baghdad, which apparently we've done well,
mm-hmm.
and we push him to some of the outlying areas with the countryside, I'll say the word countryside just for the lack of a better description. I mean, if you move him out to some of the rural areas,
mm-hmm.
isn't that, from a military standpoint, isn't that easier for us? Because when they're out there in the open and you go after them, you don't have to worry about the collateral damage that would happen in an urban area. I mean, if they're hiding in somewhere, you can use certainly a lot more lethal force than if you were fighting them in the middle of a neighborhood where you don't want to, you know, run the chance of killing a bunch of kids and a bunch of women and then having the, you know, the international press putting that on the front page of the newspapers the next day. Am I onto something there?
That's a yes and no kind of question. Especially with what's going on in Iraq, it's kind of a you're seeing a multi different facets. I'm in the middle of reading General Petraeus's the new counterinsurgency manual, and basically, militarily, they can't, as a large group, get 30-100 people together and go and attack a place. They basically can't do that anymore as a within the city of Baghdad.
You mean Al-Qaeda cannot do that anymore?
Yeah, well, pretty much. I think it's getting the point throughout a lot of parts of the city, if any of these larger groups get together, you know, someone's going to notice. You know, there's enough of the people of Baghdad have been sick of what's been going on, have been calling in. But if you have a group of, say, five people who are able to pull a car into someone's garage, work on that, you know, pack it full of explosives, and then, you know, take it off someplace, you're starting to see the separation between a guerrilla counterinsurgency and an urban-based terrorist organization. And with an urban-based terrorist organization, basically, that's no longer, you're not dropping bombs on anyone. You're knocking on someone's door or kicking in someone's door. Not to go after these groups. So yeah, moving out to further to the countryside is also losing their bases of operation, and they need to have the money, the facilities, and the people in order to be able to conduct their operations.
We're talking to Jonathan Henry. We've had him on before. He's got a wonderful website that I would recommend that you check from time to time. I certainly do. The website is called Open Source Intelligence Analysis Network, and the link is osianinteel.com, and it's a very interesting website, and Jonathan has been kind enough to join us today and tell us a little bit about what's happening in Iraq. Now, just to follow up on what you just said, you've written a new report for November. You've been doing this. You write these summaries for the month of November. What does your analysis say that you just published? Give us some highlights of that.
Let me see. Basically, you know, we're seeing more and more stability. I think for the month of November, we've seen probably the lowest level of activity. I think it was like 16% for anti-Iraqi forces, which means Al-Qaeda, their member organizations, the breakout groups, the Shiite extremist groups, and the Iranian-backed groups there. With Al-Qaeda, you know, basically most of the stuff that's going on with them is in the northern part of the country, within the city of within Baghdad and south of Baghdad. As we start seeing some of the break off of Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi army throughout the country, Diwaniya and Nasiriyah, and further south, that's where you have the majority of that group's activity going on. In the north, you have the Kurdish Workers' Party, and they're just they made a really bad decision last month of trying to attack the Turks and use Iraq as a base of operations.
Let me ask you a question about an article that I saw yesterday on Strategy Page, maybe, and that's a website that you write for as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a very interesting article because I think it could be, you know, we don't want to get too excessively optimistic, but I think it could be foretelling the future a little bit. The article talks that basically says that American troops and Iraqi troops are finding out that Al-Qaeda is having a very difficult time recruiting people.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the reason they're having a difficult time recruiting people is because so many Iraqis are turning against them, and they turned against them to a large degree because of the violence and the horrific things they were doing. You know, when you walk into a market and you kill a bunch of people, you're probably going to kill a bunch of people. I mean, you're not going to make a lot of people happy. I don't care what the cause is, but, you know, if you kill somebody's son, you know, the mother's not going to be very happy about it. So a lot of the public opinion has turned against them. But the key thing about the article is that we're seeing more and more young boys, that Al-Qaeda is actually now recruiting boys because they can't get young men anymore. And so they're using boys, and, of course, boys are not as effective as soldiers because they're boys, after all.
Mm-hmm.
They're not as effective. You know, they don't carry out missions with the same discipline. And if we capture them, they're more likely to tell us, you know, who gave them the bomb or who's supporting them. So that's opening up even more information for our guys. Did you have a chance to see that? And, of course, if that is true, or if that is a trend, then that is a very good trend, because that, you know, the same thing happened in World War II and in other wars. When you start seeing the enemy basically relying on boys, it usually means they're losing pretty bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't read that article on Start Strategy Page, but I have seen other articles out talking about the number of combatants that they're catching under the age of 17, of under 17, in between 17 and say 11, and this is, I mean, for them it's sort of, you know, for the native Iraqis, is sort of these people see these terrorist groups as sort of like the like you would see in the, gangs here in America. And that's what, you know, kind of attracted this romantic idea of being outlaws and so on like that. And, you know, probably not too long after they're in, they kind of realize what they've gotten themselves into. It's kind of the same, you know, the same process you kind of see here in urban cities here in America. You know, one of the things is to be able to get them off the streets is to put them in school. That's one of the things that we're continuously working on with the Iraqis, is to build up and create more schools and more job opportunities for these kids.
Now, one last thing. The political progress, of course, that's always the big question mark. You know, that's what that's in a sense, that's become the criticism now of the war. It used to be the military. Now the military is doing quite well, so now they're criticizing the political progress. How optimistic, how realistic are you about this country putting some of these political differences aside and coming together as a whole nation?
I think a lot of people who really make these criticisms don't really have that much of a handle on the way Arab culture and society operates. You know, you always think the way they do, you know, especially in Iraq, the way they do politics is sort of a brinkmanship kind of thing. Is kind of the same way you would negotiate in an Iraqi souk or a marketplace. You know, you go ahead and say, "Oh, I'll sell you this for $100. I'm not going to buy that for $100. I'll buy it for $50. Okay, I'll sell it to you for $50. Or maybe I'll sell it to you for $80. $80, I can get it from my friend for maybe $75. Okay, well then, how about $73? You know, and that's the kind of the way you'll see these negotiations. A lot of these extreme elements within the political system have really backed down. Muqtada al-Sadr has really backed down from his claims, and you see a lot more constructive dialogue between the more extreme Sunni and Shiite groups. They're pretty much coming together. But with the actual these kind of artificial, I don't know what you want to call them. That the Congress has kind of laid down these different rules and so on for political measurement are really not helpful at all.
Well, they're more, I think, for our benefit. I mean, they're more for our political benefit. In other words, I think I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I think that's what the Congress is doing. A lot of these Democrats, I mean, they're imposing these deadlines on the Iraqi government. And a lot of it is just political. It's for our own domestic consumption. It doesn't necessarily take into account the reality of Iraq. I mean, the truth is, and I'm going to say something that will make the Democrats angry, but I mean, look, the Democrats can't even run their own Congress.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, what are they doing telling the Iraqis what to do? I mean, you got a Democrat Congress right now with like 22% approval, according to the latest Gallup. I mean, it would seem to me the last people in the world who ought to be preaching to any other parliament about running things would be our own Democrats. But, you know, that's a political statement. I understand that, but I think there's truth to it.
Yeah, I that's one of my favorite points as well. I mean, and, you know, taking care of, you know, just being able to put together a budget is a part of the mandate of the Constitution of the United States for Congress. But for to be able to put the same leverage on Iraq, to be able to do something as complex as being able to figure out how are you going to run oil revenues? That's something you can put down as a little benchmark, but it's more complicated than a lot of these folks really really understand and imagine. De-bathification, we've already seen kind of an ad hoc de-bathification process in now. I mean, we have I've discussed before the Concerned Local Citizens Program. The head of the Unconcerned Local Citizens Program is a former Baathist leader, and I can't remember his name right now. I think it's Al-Obaidi. And he's been made gotten his old rank of Brigadier General back, in order to run the Concerned Citizens Program. So there's been a lot of de-bathification going on, kind of outside the really solid political structure.
No, I agree with you. I think there's been a lot of political Congress and, I mean, political progress, and we have to understand it, or we have to look at it, not in the context of our political differences here, but in the context of a country that, my goodness, just 5 years ago, 4 years ago, we captured Saddam Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a country that 5 years ago was being run by one of the most brutal men of the last 100 years. I mean, the psychological damage that was done to the people of Iraq was tremendous by this man, and I think it's remarkable, really, that they've done as much as they have,
mm-hmm.
considering all the difficulties that they have. Well, listen, Jonathan, we want to thank you again for giving us your time. We like to check with you from time to time. When I see your new report, I'll give you a call. Obviously, always feel free to email me if you feel that something needs to be talked about, because, you know, You're in that world more than I am, so you know when something important happens.
Mm-hmm.
But always feel send us an email. But I want to thank you very much for giving us your input, and I just want to wish you a Merry Christmas to you and to your family, and I hope you don't get a lot of snow.
Yeah. Well, you know, the snow just really adds to the atmosphere and gives it a good Christmas feeling. The one place I am going to start watching is going to be Lebanon. So that's going to be a really interesting place within the next a couple of weeks or so.
All right, you let us know if there's anything there that you would like to talk about, just send me an email and
okay.
we'll set up a show because, as I say, you're a very important voice and we enjoy talking to you a great deal. One more time, I don't have your website in front of me, but
okay.
at the moment, please give us that website address again.
It's OCN Intelligence. That's OSIANINTEL.com.
Great. I really recommend to everybody to check it out. It's really a good website. Jonathan, Merry Christmas, and we'll hopefully talk to you soon.
All right, you too. Merry Christmas.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that was Jonathan Henry, the website, of course, that we just mentioned. I would strongly encourage you to check it out. There's a lot of good information there. He does a monthly report from Iraq, and these are the kinds of things that you need to be reading as you form an opinion of what's happening in Iraq. The reality is there's a lot of good stuff happening in Iraq, and unfortunately there are too many people in our media, and I'm not even going to talk about the Democrats, but there's too many people in our media invested in defeat, and they're having a very difficult time dealing with what's happening in Iraq because they went out in front and they bet on the wrong horse. That's exactly what happened. They bet on the wrong horse, and now they have to deal with the consequences. Let me just switch gears a little bit here and talk about this baseball situation, which, of course, has been the talk of the last 24 hours, the last 48 hours. And it came, for the Democrats, it was kind of bad timing because they had a debate, and nobody's talking about the debate. Everybody's talking about the baseball thing. But let me just kind of give you my two cents on this as a baseball fan. Normally, I don't really like talking about baseball in the middle of December unless there's a trade or a free agency signing. This is football season, and we need to be talking about football. But unfortunately, baseball has forced itself on the stage and in something that, frankly, is not a good topic, and that is this whole issue of steroids. This is what I think about it. Before 1976, really for much of the 20th century and for whatever baseball as a professional sport was played in the 19th century, so let's say for roughly 100 years of professional baseball, you had something called the Reserve Clause. And for those of you who are not very familiar with baseball history, the Reserve Clause was an arrangement that the owners had with the players. And under the Reserve Clause system, basically the players didn't have any rights. I mean, the players were basically property of the team. So if you were, let's say, Mickey Mantle, Joe DiMaggio, Willie Mays, Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Ted Williams, you know, the great names of the 20th century, if you were one of these players, you basically didn't have any rights. You played for whatever team drafted you, and the only way you could be moved to another team would be if you got traded or if you got released. Now, released usually came when you were no longer a viable player, so you got released, and then you were free to negotiate with anybody. But usually by that time, most of your skills had diminished anyway, so you didn't have that much leverage to negotiate. All of that changed in 1976 when there was a legal opinion where basically the players' union challenged Reserve Clause. They won. A judge basically said that the Reserve Clause was unconstitutional, it was unfair, which it was, by the way. I agree with the judge. And then free agency came into being, and free agency is what we have now, where a player, after so many years, can go out and just negotiate with whatever team they want to negotiate with. Now, of course, the impact of free agency is that it had a tremendous boost on player salaries. I mean, if you go back to 1971, let's say, in the last two or three years of the Reserve Clause, Carl Yastrzemski was the highest-paid player in baseball, and he was making like $200,000. And then, of course, in 1976, the first crop of free agents came, and people like Reggie Jackson, Don Baylor, Bobby Grigg, people like that, we're making maybe $500,000 in the first crop. Then came 1980, when Nolan Ryan became the first major league player to get a $1 million contract. So that's the way it was. It kept building and building, and then you had a strike in 1981 where the union basically, you know, went on strike, and they had an agreement. But the salaries kept coming up and going up and going up. And one of the unintended consequences, really, of the free agency and the new system, and I say unintended because I don't think a lot of people really thought this through. One of the unintended consequences was that baseball was left without a commissioner or a commissioner with any power to do anything. And as a consequence of that, the game, while it went on, a lot of money was being made by the players, a lot of money was being made by the owners. Really, the game was actually doing quite well as a business. But unfortunately, there was no one in that business who could literally say, hey, I'm going to do this for the interest, not just of the fans, but for the interest of the business. And that's why we have this scandal that we have right now, because there was never a commissioner with the authority to say, you know what, I don't care what the union says, I don't care what the owners say, there's going to be drug testing. And if there had been drug testing in baseball for the last 15, 20 years, we would never have what we have now, which is a bunch of players under a cloud and a bunch of records that were broken, like the single season home run record, the all-time record that Barry Bonds just broke. And not just that, even some pitchers are now part of this too. I mean, you have Roger Clemens, you know, pitching until he's 43, 44 years old. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, Roger Clemens is apparently denying all of this, and I hope he's right. Believe me, I'm a big fan of Roger Clemens, and I would love to see Roger Clemens prove to the rest of us that he wasn't doing this, because I'm a big fan of Roger Clemens. I love Roger Clemens. He's great. He's been a great asset to the game of baseball. But the bottom line is that this is a public relations disaster for Major League Baseball. All these records, all these statistics, and as everybody knows, statistics in baseball are different than any other sport, because statistics are part of the history of baseball, because professional baseball has a much longer history than any of the other sports, perhaps with the exception of hockey in Canada, where they've been playing professionally for a long, long time. So this is a public relations disaster for Major League Baseball, and I hope that the union and the owners sit down over the next few weeks, that they sit down and they give the commissioner of Major League Baseball, Mr. Selig. And by the way, I'm not bashing Mr. Selig, because I don't think he had the authority to do much of anything. I mean, he was the commissioner of the game, but in many ways he was a figurehead. So I hope the union and the owners get together and they give the commissioner the authority to implement drug testing, at random drug testing. They have some right now, but it has to be very, very harsh, and I think the penalties have to be very harsh. The first time, maybe you're out 50 games. The second time, you're out of baseball. But I really believe that the game has to clean itself up, and it's up to the owners, and it's up to the union to do it. Because if they don't do it, the fans are going to do it, and the way the fans are going to do it is by not buying tickets. So there's going to be a tough economic consequence to the game if the union and the owners don't get their heads together and do something about it. So anyway, that's my two cents on this. I'm still going to be a baseball fan, but I am disappointed greatly by what's happened. The game is a beautiful game. It is the greatest of all games, as they say, but this is obviously not a good week for Major League Baseball with this kind of information. Anyway, this is Silvio Canto thanking you very much for listening to the show. We thank Jonathan Hendry for joining us. And I'm going to be signing off here December 14th, and we may be getting some ice over the weekend. So if we do, I'll tell you about it on Monday. Have a great weekend, everybody. Again, this is Silvio Canto signing off December 14th, 2007. We're literally 11 days from Christmas. And if that doesn't make you feel like you're getting old in a hurry, I don't know what does. Have a great weekend, everybody, and we'll talk to you later.